Chapter 1. Questions and Answers. Question. Is the doctrine of the mutual interpenetration of all phenomena a logical development of the doctrine of conditionality, or does it represent an entirely new vision of existence? Sangharakshita. It does not represent an entirely new vision so much as a new expression of the Buddhist vision. The doctrine of interpenetration is concerned with the nature of ultimate reality, which can be approached in various ways. The Pratitya-samutpada, condition co-production, doctrine takes a phenomenological approach, this being, that becomes, and so on. That phenomenology has certain metaphysical implications which are not brought out in the Theravada, but emerge in the Mahayana, especially in the Madhyamika's interpretations of the Shunyata teaching. The fact that all phenomena, or dharmas, are reducible to Shunyata was already there in the Pratitya-samutpada teaching, but the Madhyamika simply drew attention to it. Multiplicity was thus reduced to unity, for dharmas are many, and Shunyata, at least for the purposes of discourse, is one. Subsequently, practitioners of the Yogacara school came to see reality not in terms of Shunyata, but in terms of the one mind. In reducing the multiplicity of mental phenomena to absolute mind, however, they too thought in terms of a reduction of multiplicity to oneness, diversity to unity. The creator of the Avatamsaka Sutra, which, like all Mahayana sutras, is traditionally ascribed to the Buddha, was satisfied neither with the original Hinayana position nor with the subsequent standpoint of the Yogacara. To use Western terminology, he saw that both unity and multiplicity are just concepts. Given that the nature of reality is ultimately inexpressible through concepts, the question is, how to use those concepts to at least hint at its nature. In the Avatamsaka Sutra, therefore, the concepts of unity and diversity are combined to give at least a more adequate expression of the nature of reality. All things are not seen in the One, nor is the One seen in all things, but rather each individual thing is seen in every other individual thing. Question. So could the contemplation of the doctrine of mutual interpenetration be more useful to Dharma practice than the doctrine of Shunyata? Answer. Until you have reached a relatively refined level of spiritual practice, there is little point in exploring metaphysical subtleties. While you are still finding it difficult to concentrate the mind or practice mindfulness in the affairs of everyday life, it is more important to focus on basic principles. If anything, I would concentrate on impermanence, which does ultimately imply Shunyata, and also has a direct connection with Pratitya-samutpada, and therefore with the possibility of spiritual progress. Close study of Pratitya-samutpada doctrine inevitably involves arriving at some understanding of Shunyata, because Shunyata is a metaphysical statement of the implications of conditioned co-production. Question. Does that mean that it is never appropriate to reflect on Shunyata? Perhaps the doctrine was only useful as a way of dealing with the highly conceptual state of medieval Buddhism. But if it isn't redundant, why continue to chant the Heart Sutra? Answer. If you do want to reflect on Shunyata, one way of looking at it is to bear in mind that the word, which literally means emptiness, really means empty of all concepts. It is a reminder to us that ultimate reality is empty of concepts, in that all our conceptual constructions are inadequate to express it. In that sense, the doctrine of Shunyata is never inappropriate, never out of date. That is not to say, however, that you need to be acquainted with all the highly technical, purely metaphysical expositions of the teaching of Shunyata. You have to bear in mind what the point of it really is, from a practical point of view. Question. Are there any Buddhist practices designed to cultivate the type of vision which Indra's net expresses? Answer. In his book, The Essence of Buddhism, Suzuki describes a demonstration given by a great Chinese master to explain the doctrine of mutual interpenetration. The master arranged mirrors and candles all round the room in such a way that every mirror reflected all the candles, and also all the other mirrors. The model is inadequate because it is static, but you could try to imagine all the mirrors and candles in motion. That will give some idea of what mutual interpenetration is like. Probably the best way of developing insight into reality through this particular way of looking at it would be to read a text rather than reflecting on this philosophical doctrine. While in a relatively concentrated state of mind, you could read to yourself a chapter of the Avatamsaka Sutra. The original sutras give a much better feeling for the nature of that particular outlook than many of the more doctrinal expositions. Question. Apart from the Avatamsaka Sutra and your example from William Blake, are there any significant descriptions of the mutual interpenetration of all phenomena in other cultures and religions? Answer. The question hinges on what you mean by phenomena. There are certain phenomena within the range of Buddhist experience which do not seem to occur within the range, for example, of Orthodox Christian thought or experience, so that the statement that all things are mutually interpenetrating would have a more restricted meaning within a Christian context than within a Buddhist one. Sometimes Christians speak in terms of Christ bearing all the sins of the world, as though all the sins are reflected in him, but not very much is said about Christ being reflected in every human being, or in material things. It's true that in a verse from the Gnostic Gospel, Jesus is represented as saying, "Split the wood, and there am I. Lift the stone, and there am I." But that text is not included in the Authorized Bible. So this does seem to be a distinctively Buddhist way of expressing a certain insight, and one which took some time to develop. The Avatamsaka teaching of interpenetration comes as the culmination of some centuries of the development of Buddhist thought. There are perhaps analogies in the various mystical traditions. Some of the more poetic Sufi mystics, who think of ultimate reality in terms of the beloved, speak of seeing the face of the beloved reflected in all phenomena, which perhaps comes some way towards the Buddhist conception. Plato also gave some thought to the question of unity and multiplicity, and seemed in the Parmenides to opt for unity as real and diversity as unreal. Question. Is there some suggestion of the doctrine of mutual penetration in the Hermetic idea, as above, so below? Answer. I suppose there is a similarity in a general way, but the Hermetic idea is about correspondence, not mutual reflection. It is perhaps misleading even to say that mutual interpenetration is reflection. It is more that each and every thing is actually present in each and every other thing. Mutual interpenetration breaks down the whole idea of separate thingness, just as the Shunyata concept of insight does. Insight here is used in the specific sense of insight into reality. In the formulation of spiritual progress known as the 12 positive nidanas, links, the stage at which insight arises is called seeing things as they really are. In the Buddhist tradition, specific meditation practices, vipassana practices, have been developed to bring about the arising insight, or rather to strengthen the insights we all have in the course of our lives, particularly at times when we are experiencing grief, contemplating great beauty, or absorbed in thought. These experiences, recollected in meditation, have a cumulative effect until, like adding grains to a weighing scale, the balance tips and transcendental insight arises. The arising of insight in this sense coincides with the point of stream entry, and it carries the same sense of irreversibility. When insight has arisen in the full sense, one is consistently able to live on the basis of seeing things as they really are. Question. Returning to Blake, you have mentioned that his poem in The Augurs of Innocence is comparable in principle to the theme of the Gandavyuha Sutra. How closely did his vision approach that of the Gandavyuha, and what particular circumstances or abilities led him to develop such a vision? Did he have access to any concentration or meditation practices, or did he develop any such methods himself? Answer. As far as I know, Blake never engaged in anything comparable to meditation practice, but we must not forget that he was an artist, and an artist does concentrate very intensively. He also had a natural visionary faculty and a very positive attitude towards life in a highly elevated sense. How he got the idea of the world in a grain of sand, it is impossible to say. Perhaps he just saw things like that, just as he saw the angel in the tree. Perhaps the things he wrote about came directly from his personal experience, even though he was well versed in the alternative traditions of his day. He seems to have been an unusually gifted person, almost from birth. Much as I admire Blake, however, it does seem to me that his vision does not really go very far towards that of the Avatamsaka Sutra. But you might find the Avatamsaka Sutra quite overwhelming and baffling. Blake, being more accessible, might be more useful to you. The only way to find out would be to steep yourself in Blake's writings for a while, then do the same with the Avatamsaka Sutra and see how you felt. Perhaps you would have a sense of deeper understanding of things through reading the Avatamsaka Sutra, or on the other hand, you might feel out of your depth and get more from reading Blake. Perhaps we do need such bridges and links from our own tradition to prepare us spiritually and even intellectually for the Buddhist texts. Without this preparation, the deeper insights of Buddhism may remain for us just matters of philosophy in the narrow intellectual sense, with no real bearing on our own lives. Question. You say that there is an urge to enlightenment which is imminent in all life, and which becomes self-conscious in the Bodhisattva. Is there some conflict between that urge to enlightenment and the ego's habitual resistance to new experience? You mention this in The Religion of Art. It seems to me that much of my behaviour, and that of those with whom I study the Dharma, is motivated more by the ego's resistance than by the urge to enlightenment. How do we encourage the urge to enlightenment to become our dominant motivation? Answer. We know that life on this planet evolved from lower to higher levels, so we are probably justified in speaking of an urge to progress in this way. A being may not necessarily want to evolve, but it may be virtually forced to in order to survive. This applies to species in the collective sense, and it is similar on the human level. We have an urge to reach higher levels, perhaps produced through the force of circumstances. But at the same time, the whole of our past and present experience is holding us back. In the case of the ordinary, worldly person, the urge to progress to a higher level has not become conscious in the individual sense. He or she just goes along with the general tide of humanity. In some people, however, there develops a partly conscious urge to go beyond, to achieve something better. This urge is usually vague and unsure to be start with, but the more it develops, the more conflict there is between that imminent urge to grow and the resistance that your being, as it already is, puts up to further development. We could perhaps divide people into three categories. There are the stream entrants, for whom there is no real conflict. Yes, they may have problems to resolve, but they cannot slip back. At the other end of the scale, there are people who are not yet individuals, but just group members, who will grow if the group grows, but not otherwise. In between are those who have developed some glimmering of individuality, and therewith some individual aspiration to reach a higher level of development. They can be pulled forward by that ideal, but also pulled back by the group working through their own group nature, or their ego, as you term it. The function of the teacher, or spiritual friend, is to encourage individuality and responsibility, to try to detach the nascent individual from the overwhelming influence of the group and encourage everything in him or her that leads away from the group. That may mean encouraging them to meditate, to develop positive emotions, to free themselves from neurotic and dependent relationships, to go on retreats, to live in a single-sex community, to be open with other people, or many other things, depending on the person and the circumstances. You need to be careful not to develop a formula and apply it to everybody. You should try to respond to the person's actual needs and help them along the path they have already started to follow, if that is a path leading to growth and development. It feels good to get people going along exactly your own path, but perhaps they need to do things differently. You need to know someone quite well to know what their needs are and see clearly what step they need to take next. If you don't think in terms of leading or guiding the other person, just in terms of being a good friend to them, everything else will grow out of that. Question. You contrast the image of the 16-year-old youth, the Bodhisattva, with the battered old monk who is the Arhat, suggesting that the youth symbolizes the ideal in the abstract, whereas the old man symbolizes the ideal in terms of historical limitations. Does that mean that it is impossible to have the fully mature altruism of the Bodhisattva ideal in concrete historical circumstances? Answer. The Bodhisattva is not young, as distinct from being old, but eternally young, which means that the youthfulness of the Bodhisattva represents something outside time and space. In the case of the Arhat, it is scarcely possible to speak of someone as eternally old, unless you think of God the Father, the Ancient of Days. So the Arhat is not just somebody who is old, but somebody who has become old. At least that is my way of interpreting it. I regard the beautiful, youthful figure of the Bodhisattva as representing the transcendental spiritual ideal as it exists outside space and time, and the Arhat is that same ideal incorporated within the historical process, manifesting under the conditions of space and time. The very fact of those conditions means that the ideal cannot manifest fully. Even if you have realized that the eternally youthful Bodhisattva represents you as a human being, can you manifest that spiritual ideal fully in your life? Your life has only a certain length, and you have only two arms, two legs, and one pair of hands. There is so much to do, and so much that you cannot do. So within the historical process, the ideal cannot actually be manifested fully by any individual, not even by the Buddha. The historical Buddha died. To manifest the ideal fully, he would have had to go on living forever and ever, and living everywhere. A limitation is automatically imposed if you are existing under the conditions of space and time as an ordinary human being. This is what the Arhat represents, and this is why I speak of him as being battered and bowed. The idea is there, but from the particular point of view I adopt here, it is there as manifested under the conditions of space and time. Question. The Mahayana usually paints a picture of the Arhat as the spiritual individualist. Is that what you are saying? Answer. No, I am adopting a different point of view, leaving aside the traditional Mahayana way of looking at the Arhat, except in terms of iconography. I am looking at the iconography afresh, and asking myself what it is saying. What does it mean to juxtapose the figures of the Bodhisattvas and the Arhats? In the Christian context, what does it mean to juxtapose those beautiful, youthful angels and those old, emaciated saints? To me, the one is the ideal existing outside time towards which one is striving all the time, and the other is the same ideal as limited by space and time, struggling to express itself despite these limitations. You can see it shining through. Sometimes, although the poor old Arhat or saint is so worn down, old and wrinkled, at the same time there is something of the youthful expression of the Bodhisattva there. This is not, of course, the way the Arhat is viewed within the Mahayana tradition, but my own particular interpretation. Question. This contrast reminds me of the distinction between the different kayas of a Buddha. Answer. Yes, the Sambhogakaya represents the ideal of Buddhahood as existing without any limitations. The Dharmakaya takes that process a step further. The limitations disappear to such an extent that the Buddha himself disappears, because even the notion of Buddha is a limitation in respect to the ultimate spiritual ideal. Question. I am aware of how much fear affects my behaviour and inhibits me from making contact with other people. Fear seems to affect other people in this way too. Does this explain the emphasis on fearlessness in the list of the things that the Bodhisattva gives? Answer. The Bodhisattva's giving of fearlessness seems to suggest that people are badly in need of it. Fear is produced by a sense of separateness, or ego, for want of a better term. You should not be surprised to experience fear in all sorts of situations. It is just an indication of the fact that you experience yourself as a self or as an ego. Whenever you experience yourself in that way, there is the possibility of fear. Until you have transcended the sense of separateness, there will be fear, because you are bound to be afraid of whatever threatens you. The gift of fearlessness is therefore ultimately the gift of insight into egolessness, and this is why it is so important. It could even be called an aspect of the gift of the Dharma, in the sense of some actual experience of insight, not just the words of the Dharma. Fearlessness is placed between culture and the Dharma in the list of the Bodhisattva's gifts. Is that significant? Well, fearlessness comes after the gift of culture because it is beyond culture. But if the gift of the Dharma means the Dharma in its fullest sense, I would say that the gift of fearlessness is included in that. Perhaps the two gifts can be distinguished, because whereas the gift of the Dharma is verbal, fearlessness is communicated directly in terms of personality. You give fearlessness to others by being fearless yourself. Does that mean being egoless yourself? Yes, exactly. Being brave is something different. Bravery is acting as though you are not afraid, even though you are, something we often have to do if we can't manage anything better. It is to some extent a spiritual quality to be able to act as though you are not afraid when you are, because it means that to some extent you have transcended the ego feeling. You are not allowing the fear, the ego sense, to dominate you completely. You may not be able to stop it affecting your emotional experience, but at least you are not letting it affect your behaviour too much. There are specific practices which address craving and hatred. Would it be useful to address fear in the same sort of way? Fear would seem not to be a primary emotion in the way that greed and hatred are. In a way, fear is included in them. But there are some specific practices for eliminating fear, like the Vajrayana practices which involve going to meditate in the cremation ground at night. People sometimes keep skulls and bones around them as a reminder, although you can become hardened to their presence if you are not careful, so that they become mere objects which do not produce any effect. Perhaps from time to time you should expose yourself to situations of which you are rather afraid. Take the example of giving a talk for the first time. You feel reluctant and nervous. You are afraid of failing, afraid of what other people will say, afraid of making a fool of yourself. But you get over that first experience, and the time comes when you can deliver a talk without any experience of fear at all. And that indicates that the ego has been overcome, at least to some extent. What is the source of the story about the famine, the old man, and the young man? I think I may have adapted it from a story told to me by a bhikkhu friend in India, so it is semi-traditional. It is 15 years since you gave this talk, and during that time the Theravada has been taught more widely in the West. Would you modify the parable in any way if you were to tell it now? Is there more proselytizing on the part of the Hinayana these days? Things have changed over the last few years, particularly because Buddhists from different schools have had more contact with each other, at least in the West, and partly because of certain political and cultural events, like the fact that so many Tibetan Buddhists have left Tibet. But proselytization is not necessarily indicative of a bodhisattva attitude. Indeed, the word itself is slightly pejorative in the same kind of way as Hinayana. Very often, Buddhist monks and teachers from all Buddhist countries tend to spread just their own culture. Their motives are religio-nationalistic rather than purely spiritual, so their proselytization, or proselytizing, cannot really be classified as an expression of bodhisattva-like outward-goingness. In fact, in terms of attitudes towards the propagation of Buddhism in the modern world, there is not really much difference between any of the schools, regardless of what they call themselves. They have all got some representatives, whether monastic or lay, who have a genuine feeling for other people and wish to share the Dhamma with them, whether they are teaching it in Theravada, Tibetan or Zen terms. And I am quite sure that in all the major schools and traditions, there are at least a few people who have some spiritual experience, some inner strength, and who go out to others with the Dhamma on that basis, just as there are also those who are anxious to gather disciples or spread their own national Buddhist culture, or even just rake in the money. The important thing to realize is that you can only really go out to others spiritually when you have something to give. It is unwise for any Buddhist to go out to teach others just because he or she feels like it. Your outward-goingness must be a natural expression of your spiritual experience and spiritual strength. So, do you think this difference between a Hinayana attitude and a Mahayana attitude is mainly a question of spiritual maturity? Is it the case that, whichever school you follow, you will reach a point of spiritual maturity on the basis of which you will want to go out to people? I think that is true, but there is far greater traditional support for one in that position within the Mahayana, in the historical sense, than within the Hinayana. In the oldest Pali texts, which speak of the Buddha as an example, there is the same outward-going basis, at least in principle, that is found in the Mahayana. Many Buddhist schools in Theravada countries, however, do not go back that far, so their followers do not get the support for going out to others that a Mahayanist in a similar position would have. The Bodhisattva ideal is certainly known in Theravada countries, but it is an exception to the rule, whereas in Mahayana countries it is the rule for spiritual life. But we must not allow ourselves to be misled by labels. Someone may be teaching the Dharma on the basis of the Pali scriptures, but their teaching may not necessarily be a narrowly Hinayanistic form of Buddhism. In the same way, a Lama may be teaching in terms of the Mahayana or the Vajrayana, but he is not necessarily communicating a Mahayanistic or Vajrayanistic attitude. Often there is a correspondence, but equally often there is not. We must be able to read the real message that is being conveyed, regardless of the particular language. You may meet a Theravada bhikkhu who assures you that you should devote yourself entirely to your own salvation and enlightenment and not bother about other people, but he may be the most kind and considerate person towards you. On the other hand, you may meet a Lama who recommends that you should devote yourself as a Bodhisattva to saving millions of human beings, but who is very selfish and self-centered in his own behavior. One must not be misled by words or professions. Obviously, Hinayana is a pejorative term. What did the Hinayana schools call themselves? Oddly enough, they seem not to have used a collective term to describe themselves. Each Hinayana school, the Theravada, the Sarvastivada, the Mula Sarvastivada, the Mahasanghikas, and the Bahu Srutiyas, seem to have thought of itself just as that school, so that they had no collective designation to distinguish themselves from the Mahayana. Perhaps they just thought of themselves as the Buddhist schools. Do you think they identified themselves with each other as having certain factors in common at the time, or has that become clear in retrospect? There must have been some sense of solidarity. They do seem to have been aware that they differed from the Mahayana, and from the evidence we have, it would seem that they quite consciously refused to accept the Mahayana sutras as the word of the Buddha. As they did not use any collective term, and as we cannot use Theravada in all circumstances, because the doctrines of the various schools differed, we must make do with the rather uncomfortable word Hinayana, even though we are well aware of its limitations and slightly pejorative character. From a broader point of view, the terms Hinayana and Mahayana really represent attitudes rather than a particular doctrinal school. How can you say that a Tibetan Buddhist who does not really care for teaching the Dharma to other sentient beings is a Mahayanist, even though he may be well versed in what is technically Mahayana teaching? If a bhikkhu from Thailand or Sri Lanka is very concerned with the welfare of others and with spreading the Dharma, can you really describe him as a Hinayanist? He may be teaching what is traditionally regarded as Hinayana doctrine in its Theravada form, but his attitude is thoroughly Mahayanistic. It is better to try to use these terms, Hinayana, Mahayana, and Vajrayana, in such a way that they become descriptive of attitudes.